Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Network Europe, a partnership of the continent's leading international broadcasters. Hello, Nick Champeau here, and a warm welcome to this week's program. Coming up, they're either racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic, or all of those things, and they're gaining ground in Europe.
We have Alessandro Mussolini, who, of course, is a descendant of Benito Mussolini, the former fascist leader of Italy. We have Mr. Bruno Gollnisch from the French National Front. And then we have the Attacca Party from Bulgaria. It's a new addition to the European Parliament. So these are some pretty controversial people.
We'll have a full report on the new European far-right group from our EU insider in Strasbourg.
I love the idea of the Queen being here in Paris, but she has to be careful. You know, we cut the neck of one king here in France.
The Queen of England could have ruled over France. No, it's not a hoax. This is what the French premier proposed to London in 1956. In Poland, the conservative government and the church are leading a new drive to tackle the communist past of the country. These stories and more in this week's Network Europe, so stay tuned. But first, to our main story. The far right now has a group in the European Parliament in Strasbourg. 20 controversial nationalist Euro MPs from 7 member states managed to join forces to form an alliance this week. The group is called Identity, Tradition, Sovereignty. Its founder, Bruno Gollnisch of France's National Front Party, claims it has the backing of 23 million Europeans. As a formal group, it will be entitled to up to 1 million euros in funding and more speaking time. Our EU insider, Stephen Castle, joins us from the radio studios of the European Parliament in Strasbourg. Stephen, the creation of this new group was made possible thanks to the arrival of 2 far-right MPs from new member states, Romania and Bulgaria, but it also illustrates a trend. The far-right is gaining ground in Europe.
That's true. This is not, of course, the first time there's been a far-right group in the European Parliament. There was one in the 1980s. But I think what we've seen throughout this decade across Europe is a series of elections in which the far right have done extremely well in several countries. And as a consequence of that, you actually have far right parties in power, in coalitions, in Austria, in Slovakia, in Poland.
But how controversial, Stephen, are the members of this new group? Perhaps you'd like to give our listeners an idea and give us a sample of the comments that they've made. I know that Alessandra Mussolini has made some shocking homophobic remarks in the past couple of weeks.
Well, indeed, we have Alessandra Mussolini, who, of course, is a descendant of Benito Mussolini, the former fascist leader of Italy. We have the Attacca Party from Bulgaria. It's a new addition to the European Parliament because Bulgaria's just joined. Their MEP here, Dimitar Stoyanov, he has been making comments attacking the Jewish establishment, which he says manipulates Jewish people. So these, I think it would have to be said, are some pretty controversial people.
Yeah, Alessandra Mussolini said, "I'd rather be a fascist than a faggot." So what brings them together is that they're controversial, but do you think that they can form a coherent movement, though?
Well, I think there are some common features. They tend to be drawn from nationalist parties at home, which tend to be, for example, anti-immigration. They tend to be against the accession of Turkey into the EU. But apart from that, you would have to say there isn't a vast core of policies in common. So I don't think you could say that this is a hugely cohesive group.
I think that Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of the French National Front, even confessed that they all hated each other recently.
Well, I think there is certainly a lack of brotherly love among a number of these parties. I think it's inevitable in a sense if you bring together a series of nationalist politicians who are thinking very much in domestic nationalist terms, that they that their pan-European spirit is going to be perhaps a little bit lacking.
But they need, Stephen, a common platform to form a group. Now, tell us more about the rules and about the financial and political advantages that are at stake here and what they need to do to become a genuine group, because their platform is going to be under scrutiny, I think.
Well, that's true. Under the European Parliament's rules, you need to meet a certain threshold in order to qualify officially as a formal group. Now, that's important in the European Parliament, because only if you are an official group do you get official funding from the European Parliament, and do you get those enhanced speaking rights in the chamber and the important chairmanship and vice chairmanship of various powerful committees here which deal with a lot of important legislation. Now, in order to qualify for this, the new group needed 20 MEPs from 6 countries, and they needed to satisfy the European Parliament that they have a coherent common platform. So far, they have managed to do that, although socialist MEPs have tried to refer this whole issue back to the Constitutional Affairs Committee, which will look to examine whether or not they do meet that threshold of having a common platform. Even if they do that, socialist MEPs are going to try and block them from getting the vice chairmanship of committees simply by voting against them. It would be a breach of conventions, but the socialist MEPs are saying, well, we're not going to vote for fascists.
Stephen Castle, Network Europe CEU Insider on the line from Strasbourg. Thank you very much. It'll be interesting indeed to see whether socialist MEPs will succeed in blocking this new far-right group and whether nationalist members of Identity, Tradition and Sovereignty will manage to put their differences aside. Far-right parties, as Stephen said, tend to have an anti-immigration platform, and illegal immigration is a growing concern among Europeans and politicians. But mainstream politicians are refusing to let the far-right monopolize the debate on immigration. This week, actually, at a meeting of justice and interior ministers in Germany, EU Commissioner Franco Frattini urged member states to step up cooperation to handle the influx of would-be migrants. Deutsche Welle's Greg Benzo has more.
About 500,000 illegal immigrants enter Europe each year. Some countries, like Spain, Italy, and Malta, are seriously strained by the influx. That's why, following Germany's lead as the current head of the EU rotating presidency, member states are looking to tighten their border controls and moving to have illegal immigrants sent back to their home countries. At their meeting in Dresden, Europe's interior ministers agreed to establish bilateral repatriation accords with African countries like Mali, Senegal, Gambia, and Mauritania, whose nationals often make the perilous journey to Europe illegally in rickety boats. At the same time, the ministers are looking to regulate the flow of those migrants who do arrive. EU Home Affairs Commissioner Franco Frattini said the aim was to encourage people to come to Europe to work, for example, in the tourism or farm industries, but then to return home.
The point is offering legal possibilities of getting a job. Second, helping people in professional training and in language training. Third point, origin countries will have to guarantee the repatriation of overstayers.
German Interior Minister Wolfgang Schäuble said he backed the scheme because if the countries in question are going to help stem the flow of illegal immigration, you have to give something in return. He noted that the German government, for example, spends 140 million euros a year for special language and civics courses for foreigners. Minister Schäuble stressed, however, that although the state must offer immigrants a perspective, these new arrivals have an obligation to adapt to European culture.
Erfolgreiche Integration ist eben nicht etwas, was zufällig oder von alleine geschieht.
Successful integration is not something accidental, he says. It requires that immigrants adapt. If you want to live here, you must be prepared to pursue your own integration.
Ihr Leben, der muss auch bereit sein, bei seiner eigenen Integration mitzuhelfen.
In other decisions, a large majority of interior ministers voiced support for a proposal to share DNA and fingerprint data to fight crime and terrorism. They also agreed to consider action against the sale of violent and degrading video games to minors. The EU ministers suggested a voluntary code of conduct, which would include age restrictions and parental advisory warnings. The debate on banning so-called killer games has been fueled in Germany by an incident last November in which an 18-year-old computer game addict shot and wounded 11 students at his school before killing himself. Other issues discussed at the two-day conference were efforts to combat cybercrime and child pornography.
Thanks to Deutsche Welle's Greg Benzo for that report. You're listening to Network Europe. Now let's move east to Warsaw. A special commission will look into the past of Polish bishops and priests to see whether they were communist agents. The Polish Roman Catholic Episcopate is considering disclosing documents related to the cooperation of a minority of priests and bishops with Poland's communist regime. The decision followed the resignation of Archbishop Stanisław Wiergus, who confessed to collaborating with the communist secret police 2 weeks ago. Joanna Neifeld from the Polish Radio External Service reports.
The Church is not afraid of the truth, even if that is a difficult, shameful truth, and it sometimes hurts, said Polish bishops in a pastoral letter to the faithful 1 week after Archbishop Wiergus stepped down over his past involvement with the communist regime. The bishops therefore announced a forthcoming complete disclosure of documents and known facts pertaining to the involvement of a minority of priests in collaboration with Poland's communist authorities. The decision came after a special meeting of the episcopate. Reports on all communist-era bishops are to be drafted and sent to the Vatican for further review. Father Józef Kloch, spokesman for the Polish Episcopate, hopes that the Church will give a good example for other professional groups to come clean about their communist-era sins.
Oto grupa, która nie podlega sprawa polskiego lustracji.
There is a group that is not bound by law to go through the vetting process, and this group is the first one to say, yes, we want our documents to be examined. This is a way of expressing hope that others who are required by law to do this will follow suit.
Having written a lot on the issue of the persecution of the Church by the communist regime, most notably brutal murders on priests by communist secret services, independent investigative journalist Leszek Szymowski welcomes the intention of the Church to purge itself of communist leftovers.
The persecution of the Church by the communists largely depended on those among the clergy who collaborated with the communist regime. There are priests that still hide the fact of their collaboration with communists, and these priests can now be blackmailed by post-communist forces to push forward post-communist agenda hostile to the Church. That's why it is vital that all these past sins are now revealed. The guilty parties should apologize and free themselves of this problem. Faithful will forgive them. I am sure of it.
Polish MEP and historian Professor Wojciech Roszkowski sees the bishop's decision to face the past as, in a way, revolutionary.
We are witnessing a breakthrough in the episcopate. Finally, the bishops are willing to take this challenge.
Professor Roszkowski added that he did not understand the anti-cleansing position taken by some bishops and the circles of the populist Catholic Radio Maria, who tried to glorify Archbishop Wiergus. He pointed out that this, in fact, is standing in opposition to the Vatican and putting the Church unity at risk. Among those who traditionally oppose squaring accounts with Poland's communist past are also the circles of the liberal daily Gazeta Wyborcza and its editor-in-chief, Adam Michnik. Usually questioning the validity of the whole vetting or lustration process, in this case, Paweł Wroński, a notable Gazeta Wyborcza journalist, says he would like to see the communist-era documents valued more than the denial of guilt coming from the accused.
What is important, I think, is that so far it could be seen that the word of a bishop was valued more than the communist documents from the Institute of National Remembrance. I hope that after the case of Archbishop Wiergus, this proportion will be reversed.
Among the faithful, voices can be heard that the call for the truth is coming late. But many still react positively and declare that the disclosure of even the most difficult truth will not shake their belief in God, and the bishop's latest move actually strengthens their belief in the Church.
I think it's good that they took a stand on that. I trust in God, I don't trust in people. My faith has not changed. I believe as I used to.
greeting pilgrims from Poland after the Angelus prayer at St. Peter's Square on the Sunday following the episcopate announcement, Pope Benedict XVI spoke of the need to seek the truth, referring to the situation in Poland.
That was Joanna Neifeld from the Polish Radio External Service. You're listening to Network Europe. For the first time, Europeans might get some genuine free market choice when buying an international train ticket. Competition is being introduced in Europe's rail transport sector after a recent decision at the European Parliament to approve proposals to liberalize the market. But will there be genuine choice, and how do Europe's rail passengers feel about foreign trains rolling along home tracks? Radio Netherlands' Matthijs Nieuwenhuis reports from Brussels.
Janine Hennis-Plasgaard, you are a member of the European Parliament for the Dutch Liberal Party, VVD. Why do we need more competition for international railways?
Well, at this moment, rail undertakings are losing share if we look at the number of passengers and if you would compare it, with, for example, with air transport. While we create more competition for the railway undertakings, we would like to increase quality and to lower the prices and to get more passengers.
What will this mean for passengers?
Well, you could compare it with the air transport. If a passenger is taking a flight, for example, Nice in France, they could choose a flight with a lot of comfort and food and so on. But they could also choose a low-cost carrier, no food, no comfort, a different way of air transport. And this is going to be the same for trains.
The train to Amsterdam from Brussels is about to leave now. A lot of people are waiting for a train. It's quite a busy train normally. And people on the train are really in favor of competition.
Definitely. Competition's always good. Comfort would be a minor issue, but for the most part, it's definitely cost.
I don't really think it would matter what company it is, as long as there's a good service and a good price range.
Price is important, and also the traveling time and the quality.
My name is Jochem Govaerts. I'm the spokesman of the Belgian Railways SNCB.
We are standing here just in front of the train to Amsterdam from Brussels. Is it really possible that very soon after the markets will be open and there will be more competition, that we can make a choice then between this train from the Dutch Railways and the Belgian Railways, or maybe a train from somebody else?
Well, I don't think it would really happen very fast or very soon that some third party will offer train transportation, because of the fact that offering trains is a high risk investment. Buying trains is a very high cost operation, and in the end, the objective will be to make profit, and to make profit with a high investment, it's not so easy. So I think new operators won't be entering quite soon.
Thanks to Radio Netherlands' Matthijs Nieuwenhuis for that report. Now to Sweden, where we look at education and the Roma community. Most Roma in Sweden don't finish school, and truancy rates are high. However, attitudes are now said to be changing, and more are recognizing the value of a good education. But now there are calls for schools to give Roma children more support. Radio Sweden's Tom McLinden has more.
In the past, an education had been seen by some Roma parents as a threat. In some way, they'd lose their children. Now, though, it's claimed attitudes are changing and there's a more positive approach among the Roma community towards schooling. But there are worries that those who do take their education seriously aren't getting the support they need from local authorities. And the Swedish National Agency for Education is to look into the matter and then advise schools on how they can improve things for Roma children. Children like teenager Natasja Belika from Stockholm.
Våra mammor, de har inte gått stor utbildning, alltså de har inte gått så mycket skolan, till exempel som min mamma, hon slutade i sexan.
Natasja explains how her mother never finished school, but that her mum wants her to be trained and have a good future.
Nu är det ett nytt liv, ny framtid.
Okej, är ni klara flickor?
At the Roma Culture Centre in southern Stockholm, young people are taught traditional Roma dancing. The course leader says interest in the classes is growing among young Roma. And at the same time, interest appears to be growing in getting a good education. Christina Rodal-Olgach is a lecturer at Södertörn University College, south of the capital, and has studied how the educational situation of Roma has changed since the beginning of the last century.
There is a strong desire or will from the Roma minority for education and for education for their children. They see school as a hope for the future. But I don't see the same response from the mainstream society. Still, there is a great lack of knowledge about the situation, the historical situation of the Roma, and research on bilingual education and so on has not been applied to the situation of the Roma.
In the past, though, have Roma families not been sometimes quite sceptical of schooling?
Yes, with all reason, because all children who didn't have the Swedish as a mother tongue were looked upon as deficient. And today we know that this is not a way to promote school success for minority children. But this monolingual and monocultural norm has been very strong within schools.
So as well as the concerns over language, were there also some family circumstances sometimes which might have made it difficult for Roma children to go to school?
Certainly, because also the family is very important. If the mainstream society has been very hostile towards Roma, we know that there has been a lot of discrimination, prejudice and racism towards Roma, and still this exists. Of course, as a parent, you also would be reluctant to send your children to school if you know that your children wouldn't be treated well at school. And also, if you got education, you didn't get a work because you were Roma, so why get education?
Why do you think attitudes have changed so much then?
I think it's a consequence of the recognition as a national minority.
Claudia Quick is 36 and unemployed. She's one of many Roma who regret not having a better education. And she told Swedish Radio that when she was young, it wasn't really a priority for those in her community, and that family was more important. I think everyone should have a good education, a good job and a goal, says Claudia. Christina Rodal-Olgach says now mainstream society needs to take a more positive approach.
Teacher education has to include the perspectives of the national minorities. If we look at school books, for example, the Roma Holocaust hardly ever is mentioned, although so many Roma were murdered during the Second World War and the Nazis. I mean, if you are a Roma pupil at school and you read about the Second World War and you see that your background, your history is not present, this also influences how recognized you feel in the society that you are living.
How bad is the problem of discrimination today then in Sweden?
It's still a very serious issue. And that also has to be worked very much around. And the importance of Roma role models in media, for example, could not be underestimated. It has a large impact. Education is also a way of survival as a minority in society.
Thanks to Radio Sweden's Tom McElinden for that report. And last but not least, now this is going to sound like a hoax, but it's not. Formerly secret documents brought to light by a recent radio documentary in Britain have revealed that in the 1950s, Paris took the extraordinary step of proposing to merge France with Britain. It was the initiative of the then Prime Minister Guy Mollet. This was no marriage of equals. The offer was that the British monarch become the French head of state and that France be integrated into the British Commonwealth. Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey has more.
Entente cordiale, yes, on good days.
but a bonding of souls? Not on your life. Yet that was what was on the table half a century ago when the then French Premier, Molly, proposed to his UK homologue that France and Britain merge, becoming one country ruled over by Queen Elizabeth II.
I love the idea of the Queen being here in Paris. You know, in fact, Paris is a more regal city in many ways, but she has to be careful. You know, we cut the neck of one king here in France. So.
The astonishing idea, brought to light by a BBC documentary, was born out of Molle's desire to find an ally with whom to combat the Egyptian president Gamal Abdel Nasser, who'd recently nationalised the Suez Canal and who was funding independentists in French Algeria. Tension was mounting along the border between Israel and Jordan, Israel being a French ally and Jordan a British one. France needed to have Britain on side in the Middle East in order to secure its help in winning back Suez. So the Anglophile Molle came to England on the 10th of September 1956 for talks with his British counterpart, Anthony Eden, during which he proposed a union between the two countries, with the British monarch becoming the French head of state. Philippe Chassaigne, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at the University of Tours, says that at the time France had many weaknesses which help explain why it put itself in such a subservient position.
French economy was not the dominant economy in Europe. On the political point of view, France was rather weakened because of political instability. And diplomatically, the French position was weak as well, both on the world stage and on the European stage. And I think that trying to get together with a country which was at the time booming, economically speaking, and a country which had a worldwide empire, colonial empire, even if it was called Commonwealth, it was still an empire, basically. Could there be something good to strengthen the French position on the world stage?
The British Prime Minister, Anthony Eden, turned down Molle's proposition for a union between France and England. But the French Premier was apparently determined to relinquish his country's sovereignty. He then suggested that France be allowed to join the British Commonwealth, telling Eden that he thought there would be no difficulty over France accepting the headship of Her Majesty. But judging by reactions to the idea on the streets of Paris today, it seems Molle may have had a poor understanding of his fellow citizens.
It's absolutely impossible to think that it could happen, and especially France and England have such different, separate point of views on so many things.
I don't know which would be the hardest, to convince the French to be English or the English to be French, but I think that the French people wouldn't have agreed to that. I wouldn't have agreed to be British.
But would the British public have accepted to merge with their neighbours, admired as they are for their savoir-vivre? I put the question to the Daily Mail's French correspondent, Peter Allen.
If you looked at the terms, and again, if it was on British terms, and Britain did the best out of it, remember Britain was once the proud owner of Calais, and British kings were always coming over to France to conquer French armies, and of course it was happening the other way around sometimes as well. They might have accepted it slowly, but who knows, in the long term, I think it certainly would have all ended in tears.
Shortly after Molle's proposal was made, the British pulled out of Suez, the struggle with President Nasser was lost, and the idea of a Franco-British union was dropped.
RFI's Hannah Godfrey. Well, I've lived in both England and France, and I agree, I have to say, with the Daily Mail's Paris correspondent, I think it would have all ended in tears. I'm afraid it's almost time to say goodbye. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll be back from Paris next week for a special Network Europe on national taboos. And after that, Network Europe will be brought to you from Stockholm. Don't forget our quiz. We'd like you to give us the name of the country which joined the Eurogroup on the 1st of January. Euro bills are now being used in 13 member states. The address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. And please visit our website if you want to listen to this program again, or visit our archives, www.networkeurope.org. That's www.networkeurope.org. For me, Nick Champeau, it's a goodbye. We'll leave you with a Brazilian band that's certainly keeping dance floors busy here in Europe. That's what's good about globalization. It produces upbeat electro-rock music from Brazil. The band is called CSS, and this track is called Let's Make Love and Listen to Death from Above. CSS coming your way. Bye-bye.